just want to reiterate that when you're asking a question, we'd ask you to use the microphone. Now, while the panel may be able to hear you, what we do have is a webcast, and the people on the webcast can't hear the question if you don't use the microphone. So we'd ask you to just wait until the microphone comes to you before you ask the question. Welcome back to the panel. Ernie Newman, Dr. Alan Freeth, Matt Crockett, and Russell Stammers. I'm going to kick off the question. As I said, I've got a number of questions here that have been given to me by other people who couldn't be here today, or people who don't want to ask the question. I'm not sure why they don't want to. So please, panel, don't shoot me if the question stopped something actually like. And I'll just kick it off by a straightforward question. Be interested to hear from each member what they define as open access. I mean, open access, one is I think it needs to be on a commercial basis. We hear a lot of talk about open access and affordable broadband from various parties. We're not still quite sure what affordable means. Generally, I think it means below cost. Those of us who are providing it. The second thing is, if people are prepared to share in risk and share their capital in some form, or whether that be a fee payment or an upfront payment to be on whatever network is open access, and we absolutely have no problems with that. So, slightly different bent, and don't get me talking about layer 1 and layer 2, because I have it all wrong. Russell, I probably don't really know. I say that in a while, because I guess the definition varies depending on which constituent uses it. It seems to move up and down in our industry from some of it. I think it's like, oh good, opening up all the ducks around the place, to then sort of, someone puts a fiber network in and we all can have a share of it for the low cost inside our arena. But I have all these you want to have a comment, Abby? I know in my head, but I'm not sure that I really want to articulate it too closely, because once anyone comes up with such a definition, there'll be thousands of lawyers in the industry trying to find a way through it. But I think it's something around the entity that controls the infrastructure has to be neutral and cannot have any interest in trading on the services or the content that run across it. If you look for analogies, we don't expect Main Freight to build its own road network. We don't expect every airline to build its own airports. And we shouldn't expect every phone company to build its own infrastructure. But having said that, whoever does control the infrastructure is going to be totally independent from the entities that have an interest in running services and technology across it. So if someone can sort that out in 25 words or less, I'll shout them up here. Okay, that's the warm up. Now we'll get into some real hard questions. Yeah, Donald. I'm a slightly different take on that, but I think leading off the open access question and maybe starting at Matt and Ernie, but welcome Russell and Alan's views as well. You talked earlier about fiber to the home. I just wonder what sort of architectural potentially using there, you know, a pod architecture or direct run architecture. Because the architecture we choose as a country has quite a significant impact on our ability to unbundle or future regulatory requirements that may be required around such a last mile fiber architecture. Now it's getting tricky. Okay, so, what we're using for at the moment is a GPON technology, but exactly how we architected moving forward, I think, isn't firmed up. I mean, and part of what we do in pilots is to learn more about how that performs, how it interfaces with a different service provider, in this case War Exchange, and to build on that. So beyond that, I'd have to get someone like Greg Patchell or Sam out of CIO to come in on that. So. I'm not sure if I can answer the question, but I can make an observation, which is that, you know, the customers we've talked to want a modem for $50. All this for free and a CPE for the end of the link is like $1,000 plus. So when you think about, you know, what you're going to architect, one of the things has to be like really low cost, because our consumers can't afford to, regardless of the technical terms, to buy some of the fiber CPE today that exists. Maybe just to add to it as well, one thing that will definitely be a feature of it is we're endeavoring to have as consistent an architecture and points of interconnection and so on for our NGN, be it either fiber or be it either copper and so on. So for example, the way that handover points and peering points and those kind of things have been defining it. There's been a lot of understandable desire from the industry to rationalize it, and I think that whatever technology we go with will make sure that it's consistent with that and doesn't create new and different challenging points for people. So if I could be cheeky from the panel and ask one of my fellow panelists a question, namely Matt, I think the unspoken question that's possibly lurking here is the way that telecom is architecting fiber to the node, providing the right foundation for that at some future time to become the basis for fiber to the home. I think you have to separate two different things. One of them is actually the physical deployment of the fiber. Obviously, the more fiber you push down the street, it's one step closer to being in the house. And the second one is actually a more of a network and IT architecture, which includes some of the points of interconnection and other things. like that. So I think the answer is that we are architecting and constructing our formative mind to keep as much options open as possible in the future. Both in terms of being able to then extend from there physically, but also in terms of the points I just raised around interconnection and other architectures at IT.world. Can any of your answer is yes? I've forgotten the question. The answer is yes. Well, I think what Matt was reflecting is it's pretty complex stuff, The answer is yes, we fully expect that if there's ever fiber going out further, that, can go from all those nodes. I think underlying the whole issue is, of course, if we make a mistake, then we basically have to go through the same rigmarole that we have with copper loop unbundling, but we won't be able to do it because the architecture's not right. That's, I think, what you were getting at, Donald, wasn't it? Any other questions? This is for Adam Preith. And as I said, it's not my question, so... Telstra Clear seems intent on a go-to-market strategy based on exclusivity to Telstra Clear. How does TCL think it will fare in the more open access future that now appears inevitable in New Zealand? Look, I just think we've demonstrated with the partnership with North Power that Eugene went out the front here and Network Tasman eventually LBs on that. It's all about capital and return. We don't mind competing, we don't mind competing in an open access technology. We will once our period of exclusive arrangement have ended. It's just been a risk sharing and a capital sharing. So I think the answer's in those types of partnerships. Where we can get a bit of return for premium products, and of course we'll do that. That's what every business does. But the world is changing, we've got to change with it. We recognize that. But I think it's important for people to remember whose capital is at stake here. And often the people who make the most arguments about open access and the ability for people to whatever it might be about the internet, forget about whose capital was first invested. Whose capital on an annual basis has been invested and to these networks. Does shareholders, that's the same people who use the networks as customers, straightforward. I'd like to challenge you on that because in both the case of North Power and Network Tasman, the initial capital was actually public capital from the form of the electricity consumers and the electricity trusts. That have actually been able to flex some financial muscles. So I think the idea of a PPP is valid, but there was not an initial shareholder-driven business case in either situation. I think it's good that commercial services come in on top and make those viable, but I think it's a bit disingenuous to say that the initial capital that went in, because in those cases, as in the original telephone network in New Zealand, this has been about the need to put public money into utilities to get them to all places where New Zealanders need them.
Yeah, but you're wrong. We're putting $1 million into this deal on the other side. If you're suggesting that my friends at North Power aren't commercially driven by the stakeholders, and this is an altruistic move by them, you're also wrong. This is a very commercial business driven case on both sides, and we have quite a bit of capital at stake in this partnership. I think the public-private investment is to be welcomed, but I think it's interesting that it's taken the lines companies to start freeing up capital for investment in fibre in New Zealand. I think that PPLs have been put back in this country by Russ Armstrong and a whole series of events about 3 years ago where politically it's been unacceptable to go into those. We've talked with a lot of government about PPLs and we just haven't got anywhere until about the last year. I don't know your experience, Russell. What's happened with Victor and ourselves and the North Shore over there and the Canterbury Development Corporation and on to the credit of the government all driven by the Broadband Challenge Fund where there's been these public-private partnerships of the form. You've been driving out fibre and investment in all sorts of networks. So that is already happening. Just following on from that, I'm a question in competitive market. You know, biography for inform back and absolutely no idea. Of those of you who were walking around Queen Street yesterday would have seen a bunch of ads on the pavement for Vector's business fiber network and so on, so I think that would be a mistake to think that nothing's happening other than where you get let's be clear, there's a hell of a lot of fiber already in the ground that our companies own and continue to expand all the time. Just while we're talking about North Power and Alan and then we'll move on to someone else to give the this is a question again that was put into us that Telstra Clear announced the major network and tower and then pulled the plug. Why should the citizens of Wanganui feel confident that Telstra will actually deliver? Now take this as a positive way in which you can actually respond to that. Mark Ratcliffe and his team are looking for whatever form is there and making the most use of it. And that's not just telecom fiber, it's other people's fiber as well. And we've got a huge upgrade commitment there, capital constraints, etc. We are looking for any and all solutions to deploy that fiber. So if there's access there and it's usable, then I suspect we'll absolutely use it, but I couldn't answer it specifically. Just mentioned the question of sufficient number of technical people to actually carry out the various projects and make them actually happen. And recently I attended excellent presentation by Andrea Mitchell from Vodafone about the reasons why they had to move some of their call center to Egypt, which is not as apparent as it was until you actually hear it. So I'd like to, first of all, perhaps, Alan, you might want to comment about the fact that you couldn't actually get enough good people here to be able to have the customer center here and drive the move to Egypt. But perhaps others would like to comment about the problem with getting sufficient qualified and capable people to be able to carry out and deliver the projects that we're looking to deliver over the next 5 years. There aren't sufficient technical people as my answer, or service people. When you go from a scenario where you've got sort of an exponential amount of work going on, whether it's ourselves, whether it's telecom, Telstra, other players, so we have a very critical skill shortage, and that is a limiting factor on our ability to grow, absolutely. That is what I think it's a substantive challenge that we're all facing at the moment. And I think we've made some headway in telecom over the last while in terms of looking at new and different models. So we've got partners from offshore like Tech Mahindra bringing down people and so on, and we're really looking at all the different levers we can to recruit in-house, look at outsourcing models, but I think we're going to have to really put a lot of spotlight on this, both as individual companies and as an industry moving forward, because it is going to be one of the constraints to do. I mean, I think our analysis of what it would take to do the 75% fiber to the home is another 200 games of For the Liars, and as I understand it, more of interest now, but certainly 3 or 4 months ago, there simply wasn't enough digging equipment in New Zealand even to do the Father to the Night, so I think these are real constraints, and there's no easy solutions, but anyways, to actually look at all the options, all the ways to innovate and change what we're doing, and not try and do it all on shore. Yeah, look, I think it's all been said, really. But it's not just telcos, it's clearly the IP industry across the whole board. And it's become a constraining factor. We've got quite a big building project at the moment going on in Kapiti. The 30 or so guys and ladies that are working on that are all offshore, mainly from India, that we've had to bring in to do that project. That's about the second time we've done that, to get the IT skills and resources. Just as a matter of interest, most of them I'm told are supporting about 30 people back in India from that work. So it's a really sort of interesting dynamic when you talk to these people. The way they view the work and how they do it, but you know, clearly global market for some of these things, but like Russell and Matt, we're just finding we're all competing for scarce resource. It's the biggest black a lot of thunder clouds hanging over this sort of discussion. The skill shortage, as the others have said, right across the economy. It's one thing the government is making a botch of. You cannot find one person in government, in the public sector, who has a sign on the desk saying the buck for the skill shortage stops here. There are little pockets of activity in all sorts of places. None of them seem to be coordinated. None of them seem to be properly resourced. And I cannot see a solution to the skill shortage on the way. And I see David Cunliffe from there scowling at me and making notes. But if there's one message I'd like him to take back, we actually need to get somebody identifiable in government who is responsible for making sure that the next generation coming into the workforce is trained for the right things. Right. There's Peter McCormick. Peter McCormick, President and NZ. On the skills shortage, we recognise that there's very low unemployment in New Zealand, but there's also a significant issue about training. And apprenticeships went away many years ago. What is happening at two ends? One is I know of 17 guys over 50 who are IT professionals who who none of you will employ. I also know of a lot of young people who'd love to get some skills, but just don't have the academic go-to to be able to do that. What are you doing about taking young people and training them? Look, I can't comment on the individual cases, but the issue we about 2 years ago on some pretty intensive discussions with Massey, for whatever reason, haven't progressed as fast as we'd like. The other issue is the demand for students to come into the IP sector is incredibly low. People just don't want to do it, or at least then. And the types of courses that we were talking to them about in IP and telco sector, for whatever reason, the perception about accountants, lawyers, or where else to go and what to expect was quite different. So we are talking, and I think as an industry there's been a number of conversations undertaken about how can we stimulate the interest. It's clearly quite a lucrative area to be in at the moment for some of the skills that we're all fighting for. But I also think at a social level that the views of science, technology, and it's going to start right down at the schools, and I mean early on and before secondary school, to get that interest is one across the whole board. I'm on a directorship of the CRI, and the same thing's there. Geologists, hydrocarbon experts, getting them out of New Zealand is impossible. Getting them worldwide now is impossible. Peter, just we are doing a few things in telecom. We've had for a few years now a graduates program where we actually bring in graduates and then they do, I think it's 6 month stints over 2 years, and then they go into the business, and it's been very successful in terms of, I think we had 95% of them stay in telecom afterwards. We've also got, I think now some, I think Gen-I does it, some Gen-I scholarships. I'm not sure with which institutes. So I think there's active things going on. I'll face up, I don't think it's enough. I think we could do more. I think we could be more coordinated as an industry, and I think, you know, there is a big role more broadly with the government as well, but you know, I think Andy's right about this dark cloud thing. I actually think a lot of the momentum is going to stall if we can't fix this problem. said winning scholarships in the universities or partnership with IUT. We employed 150 additional call center staff until we couldn't find any more that met the requirements we want. And if you have those names of those 50 people, 70 people out of 50 with good IT skills, then I'd love you to give them to me. Because if they are skilled, then I struggle to understand why they haven't got a job. I think that there are two levels of answering that question. I think from an industry level, maybe we need some kind of think tank or task force to get together and try to kick the other thing around. But I still believe it's an economy-wide issue. My father had one employer right through his life. I've had about eight, I think, from a quick count, might be nine by tomorrow morning. My kids, I expect, will have probably 10, 15 or 20. But the education system is still predicated on the basis that they're training people for their first career and then beyond that they're on their own. So we need to take a zero-based approach to how we deal with the constant changes of career and the constant changes of demands in the labour market that are much faster moving rate of economic progress is bringing to us, because it's going to get faster, not slower.
I'm sorry, I don't think I got the answer I was expecting. I know about the issues about giving young people to go through into ICT training, and there's a lot of good programs being undertaken. For instance, Accelerating Auckland to try and change that. What I was talking about is you're going to have more than 200 teams out there laying fibre. We need to have some. We're not talking about university graduates here. We're talking about people who go into a six-month training course to turn them into lower-level technicians. What's happening about that? My understanding is that there's a huge amount of training program, and there's no way you can scale up, and this includes with the downers and transfield type people. Is it as structured and coordinated as it could be? Probably not. But, I mean, there's no way that we can scale up even to do it. I mean, spending $1.1 billion is a bit harder than people think as well. It's like, in many ways, as resource-constrained as we are capital-constrained in a financial sense, because the two are quite tightly linked. So we have to do a lot of training to do that. We have to look offshore. I think we have to, as I said, pull every lever we can to try and fix that problem. Thank you for that question. Any other questions out there that someone...
from someone who's shall remain nameless. Russell, 2 years into your wholesale to Compass, Oakon, and others, how would you describe progress? Disappointing. We probably wouldn't cause a hold up by changing our billing systems last year, which a lot of you felt, because I know. But where we are right now is that it's all done, and we're hoping that people will launch now and get on and just get in the market. Alright, one last question from anyone. Before I close the session. No? Well, in that case, I'd ask you all to put your hands together for the panel. Ask you all to give a warm welcome to our Minister, David Calliffe.